Susie, long the queen on Warren's chessboard, was used to this sort of thing. She had her own definition of what he needed from the women in his life, and pigeonholed each of them into a utilitarian category. One night when she was at dinner at Garratt's with Warren, Astrid, and Sharon Osberg, whom she had recently met, she looked around the table and surveyed the company. Only Kay and Carol Loomis were missing from the harem. She laughed and shook her head. "Someone for everything," she said. She had plugged Osberg into the bridge category. But Susie always downplayed the others' roles, and like all of Warren's women friends, each had the loyalty of Daisy May. Before long, Buffett was talking to Osberg several times a day on the phone, taking her along as a traveling companion on his trips, and making her one of the closest confidants among his friends. Much like Astrid, however, she stayed in the background rather than upset the perceived order of all his other relationships, which Buffett had always tended to separate. By the mid-1990s, the public perception of how he spent his time and the way he actually spent it had long diverged. Buffett still played Twister to try to avoid hurting anyone, but as always, conflicts were resolved to appease whomever might erupt on him. The shrieking wheel got the grease. Sharon, like Astrid, was not a shrieker. She was quietly invited to Susie Jr.'s Thanksgiving dinners and included in bridge games with Bill Gates. A year after Bill and Melinda's wedding, the Gateses were celebrating their first anniversary on January 1, 1995, at their house in San Diego. Buffett invited Bill, Charlie Munger, and Sharon to come over for a New Year's Day bridge game. While Susie, long accustomed to Warren's choosing his own pursuits even in the midst of a family gathering, spent the day with family and friends, Gates, Osberg, and Buffett sat down at the bridge table to wait for Munger. Buffett, who always ran precisely on schedule, noted that it was time to begin, but otherwise ignored Munger's tardiness, since nobody else seemed bothered by it. Gates was in a pleasant mood, but as they chatted, Buffett began growing irritated that they were being kept waiting. When Munger did not appear after a few minutes, Osberg suggested a game of three-handed bridge to keep the others entertained, partnering with both Buffett and Gates while keeping up her end of the conversation. After 45 minutes of three-handed bridge, Buffett, who was playing the polite host, cracking jokes and making conversation, trying to make everything okay, had become noticeably jumpy and restless. Suddenly, he flew out of his chair. "I know where he is," he said. He snatched up the phone and called the Los Angeles Country Club. Whoever answered the phone went off to search. Within a few minutes, he had located Munger in the golf grill, sitting with his cronies, as he habitually did every day when not at the office. He was about to take a bite of a sandwich. "What are you doing, Charlie?" Buffett asked. "You're supposed to be playing bridge with us." "I'll be there in a few minutes," Munger replied. Without a word of apology, he hung up the phone, put down his sandwich, and headed out to the car. Half an hour or so later, Munger strolled into the Buffett's house at Emerald Bay, sat down at the table exactly as if nothing had happened, as if he hadn't noticed that he'd kept Bill Gates waiting for an hour and a half on his first anniversary, and said, "Happy New Year. Let's play." Stupefied, the other three sat in silence for a moment. Then Gates said, "Okay, let's play." They played. Another group of Buffett's loyal friends joined him for their biennial ritual when the Buffett group held their meeting at the Kildare Club in Dublin in September 1995. Because Bill Gates was present, for Gates straddled all of Buffett's worlds, since Buffett would have liked to become his Siamese twin, the government of Ireland treated them like emperors. They were met at the airport by official government limousines and watched over by security agents in helicopters. They dined with the chairman of Guinness, the Taoiseach, head of state, and his wife, and the U.S. ambassador, walked the cobblestones of Trinity College to the Book of Kells, and clapped their hands in awe at the sleek hunt stallions of the Irish National Stud in County Kildare. Never, even under Kay Graham's auspices in Williamsburg, had they experienced such luxury. Filled with incredible artwork and antiques, the K Club raised all of its own food on site and prepared it with a European staff and chefs. The gloss and glamour of the surroundings belied the fact that the Buffett Group members, many of them fabulously wealthy by now, were largely unchanged. Warren saw some of these people only once a year or so, yet he remained utterly devoted to them. Bill Ruane was still gregarious and told long, funny stories. Walter Schloss still lived in a tiny apartment and picked stocks the same way he'd always done. The Stanbacks, among the richer members of the group, still would not dream of flying any class but coach. Sandy Gottesman still questioned everything skeptically and wanted an override on every deal. Tom Knapp had finished buying up huge chunks of the Maine coastline and started in on Hawaii. Jack Byrne was as pumped full of energy as ever. Roy Tolles still kept his thoughts to himself, except for shooting off a one-liner every now and then. Ed Anderson and Joan Parsons pumped money into human sexuality research, but Ed still picked up pennies in the street, unless they were really dirty. Marsha Weinberg was still an irresistible flirt. Lou Simpson was still such a good stock picker that he had become one of the super investors of Graham and Doddsville. Carol Loomis had made enough money from Berkshire stock to fly in a private jet, but still couldn't buy a jar of pickles without reflecting on the luxury of pickles during her Depression-era childhood. Retired from building gigantic dams and bridges, Walter Scott now built gigantic houses instead. After going to the theater, Joyce Cohen still walked up Broadway and across the park to the Upper East Side in a snowstorm rather than take a cab. Ajit Jain, now a Buffett Group member, spent most of his time in his room during the meetings, doing deals at a furious pace to please Buffett. Ron Olson, who had once been liked by most people that Buffett knew, except Judge Bryant, was now liked by most of the people in Greater Los Angeles. Then there were Bill Scott, Mike Goldberg, and Chuck Rickershauser, all in various states of retirement from working for years close to the nice, warm sun, also all in various stages of recuperation from the effects of Rickershauser's law of thermodynamics. Bill Gates, unlike the rest in so many ways, shared the group's intellectual interests and complete lack of pretense. As for Kay Graham, she remained their one real connection to echelons of society that titillated them, even while failing to seduce them. "Oh, Princess Diana," she would say, "such a good friend. Much more there than is obvious." Amid the K Club's luxury, Buffett handed out copies of a booklet, The Gospel of Wealth, by turn-of-the-century industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. As he celebrated his 65th birthday and took stock of his life to date, he had been rereading Carnegie. Now he led the group in a debate of Carnegie's premise that he who dies rich dies disgraced. Carnegie had honored that philosophy, spending nearly his whole fortune, one of the greatest in history at the time, to establish libraries in towns and cities all over the United States. Buffett had always planned to die rich and disgraced, as Carnegie would put it, so that there would be more to give away after he was gone. He insisted that the best use of his talents was to keep making more money until he died, and he had no interest in being personally involved in the foundation's work. That would be Susie's project. But he wanted to hear what other people thought, and obviously was giving some consideration to this question. They went around the table. Bill Ruane, who had never cared much about money and was poor compared with the rest, was about to undertake a project to transform the worst of New York's public schools. He would later go on to work with Columbia University to screen thousands of New York City schoolchildren for mood disorders and suicide risk. Fred and Alice Stanback were among the most important donors to environmental causes in the United States. Tom Murphy was chairman of Save the Children. Jane Olson, Ron's wife, chaired the International Board of Human Rights Watch. Before Dan's death, the Coens had donated an important collection of art to the American Folk Art Museum. Charlie Munger gave to Good Samaritan Hospital and education. Walter and Suzanne Scott had donated huge amounts of money in Omaha. Ruth Gottesman served on the Albert Einstein College of Medicine Board of Overseers. Marshall Weinberg was gradually giving away nearly all of his money for scholarships, world health, Middle East issues, and educational research. The others had their own causes. When his turn in the conversation came, Bill Gates said, Shouldn't the measure of accomplishment be how many lives you can save with a given amount of money? He agreed with Buffett that you had to make the money first in order to have the money to give away. But as soon as he had made a certain amount, Gates said, he was going to use it to save more lives in the present by giving most of it away. The Buffett Foundation was spending very little money in proportion to Buffett's wealth. Buffett had chosen two main philanthropic issues, overpopulation and nuclear proliferation, problems that are almost unimaginably hard to solve. Nuclear proliferation didn't lend itself well to financial solutions, although Buffett would have given as much money as he could to his highest priority, any plausible way of reducing the probability of nuclear war. His analysis of the problem was, characteristically, statistical. A nuclear attack is inevitable. It's the ultimate problem of mankind. If there's a 10% probability that something will happen in a year, there's a 99.5% probability that it will happen in 50 years. But if you can get that probability down to 3%, that reduces the probability to only 78% in 50 years. And if you can get it down to 1%, there is only a 40% probability in 50 years. That's a truly worthwhile goal. It could literally make all the difference in the world. The other great problem, in Buffett's view, was the strain placed on the overburdened planet by too many people. Lacking a way to solve the nuclear problem, population control was where the Buffett Foundation had spent most of its money since the mid-1980s. This, too, he approached from a mathematical perspective. In 1950, the world's population had been about 2.5 billion. A mere two decades later, shortly after Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb was published, the world population was close to 3.7 billion. Ehrlich had predicted that the 1970s and 1980s would be times of massive worldwide starvation, with hundreds of millions of people dying. By 1990, the world's population had passed the 5 billion mark. Mass starvation had not occurred, and Ehrlich's ideas were no longer taken seriously by many experts, even though the population had grown dramatically. The debate essentially centered over whether technology could outpace population growth, species extinction, and global warming. Buffett looked at the problem of expanding population and diminishing resources in terms of a margin of safety. There is a carrying capacity to the Earth. It's far, 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 far greater than Thomas Malthus ever dreamed. On the other hand, there is some carrying capacity, and the one thing about carrying capacity is that you want to err on the low side. If you were provisioning a huge rocket ship to the moon and had enough for 200 people and didn't know how long the journey would take, you probably wouldn't put more than 150 people on the ship. And we have a spaceship of sorts, and we don't know how much the provisions are good for. It's very hard to argue that the Earth would be better off in terms of average happiness or livelihood with 12 billion people instead of 6. There is a limit, and if you don't know what that limit is, you're better off erring on the safe side. It's a margin of safety approach for the survival of the Earth. Since the 1970s, Buffett had focused on giving women access to contraception and abortion, issues that were close to Susie's heart, as the answer to out-of-control population growth. This was a standard point of view among humanist organizations at the time. Munger Tolles had gotten Buffett involved in supporting an important court case in California, People v. Belus, which was a major step on the road to the landmark abortion ruling in Roe v. Wade. Charlie Munger took up this case with a passion. The firm had chosen it out of concern over the way young women were being maimed and killed through illegal abortions. Buffett and Munger sponsored a church called the Ecumenical Fellowship, which became part of the country's abortion underground railroad. Buffett had been especially moved by the logic of Garrett Hardin, whose 1968 article, The Tragedy of the Commons, laid out the way that people who have no ownership stake in common goods, the air, the seas, overuse and destroy them. While Buffett adopted many principles conceived by Hardin, a leader of the population control movement, he rejected solutions favored by Hardin, who espoused authoritarian ideas and took a eugenicist approach. Hardin had written that the meek not only would inherit, but already had inherited the earth. He considered this genetic suicide. Look around you. How many heroes do you number among your neighbors or your colleagues? Where are the heroes of yesteryear? Where is Sparta now? Buffett thought that the idea of bringing back Sparta had already been tried. The man who had tried it was Adolf Hitler. The Spartans had groomed themselves genetically by abandoning weak or undesirable babies on a mountainside. Modern eugenics was a social philosophy formulated by Sir Francis Galton, who drew on the work of his cousin Charles Darwin and theorized that selective breeding of the human race could improve the quality of the population. This notion had received extremely widespread support in the early 20th century, until discredited by the experiments of Nazi Germany. There was no safe way to think along lines like those Hardin was pursuing, which led to a deadly division of humanity into competing groups. Buffett had renounced this view in favor of a civil rights-based approach to the problems of spaceship Earth. Accordingly, by 1994, Buffett's emphasis had shifted from population control to reproductive rights. This change corresponded with a worldwide evolution in thinking among the population control movement. Women were no longer to be treated as a convenient means toward the end of population control. Buffett had always felt that any means of solving the population problem that involved coercion was out of the question. Now he went a step further. I wouldn't in any way limit a woman's right to bear children, even if the world were extremely overpopulated. And I wouldn't ban the right to choose, even if there were only two people on the planet and fertility was critical. I think the world should be limited to wanted people first. I don't think that the numbers should determine how many people are wanted. Even if everybody had seven children, I wouldn't do as Garrett Hardin said and link the right to the numbers. So the Buffett Foundation supported reproductive rights. Increasingly, the complexities and nuances of reproductive rights, civil rights, and population control had all gotten lost in the controversy over abortion. Buffett's giving ultimately was based on what he called the ovarian lottery. He had passed the idea along to a group called Responsible Wealth. The idea had great resonance for Buffett. I've had it so good in this world, you know. The odds were 50-1 against me being born in the United States in 1930. I won the lottery the day I emerged from the womb by being in the United States instead of in some other country where my chances would have been way different. Imagine there are two identical twins in the womb, both equally bright and energetic, and the genie says to them, one of you is going to be born in the United States, and one of you is going to be born in Bangladesh. And if you wind up in Bangladesh, you will pay no taxes. What percentage of your income would you bid to be the one that is born in the United States? It says something about the fact that society has something to do with your fate and not just your innate qualities. The people who say, I did it all myself, and think of themselves as Horatio Alger, believe me, they'd bid more to be in the United States than in Bangladesh. That's the ovarian lottery. The ovarian lottery had come to shape all of his opinions about politics and philanthropy. Buffett's ideal was a world in which winners were free to strive, but narrowed the gap by helping the losers. In his lifetime, he had seen the extremes of inequality, had grown up with the lynchings and beatings of the civil rights years, and had heard over and over of the courthouse riot, authority shoved onto a scaffold with a noose around its neck, at a time and in a place when one group of people felt themselves more deserving than another. Perhaps without being aware of it, Buffett had many years ago abandoned the libertarian leanings of his father and spiritually circled back toward the democratic idealism of Nebraska's William Jennings Bryan, who had written of the class that the rest rested upon. Buffett, one of the least peripatetic people imaginable in both philosophy and geography, could make the occasional tectonic shift if enough conviction piled up. Now, after he and Susie returned from Ireland, they met in Vancouver to embark on a 17-day trip to China. Across Cathay. Buffett's motivation for this round-the-world jaunt was the Gateses. Bill and Melinda had gone to considerable trouble to make the trip enjoyable for him. Ahead of time, they sent him and the other guests a questionnaire asking what they liked to eat. Buffett was not taking any chances on an experience like the one he'd had at the Moritas. I don't eat any Chinese food, he responded. If necessary, serve me rice, and I'll just move it around on my plate, and I'll go back to my room afterward and eat peanuts. Please get me a journal every day. It's really hard if I don't have my journal. And so Buffett went to China. After checking in to Beijing's Grand Old Palace Hotel on Goldfish Lane, the tour group met Dr. Robert Oxnam, president of the Asia Society, who was to be their lecturer for the trip. Following a talk on modern China, they ate a magnificent Sichuanese dinner at the hotel's Emerald Room. Waiters placed course after course on the rotating platters: tea-smoked duck, twice-cooked pork with chili sauce, spicy chicken, and Sichuan hot pot. But the Gateses had arranged for the tour company, Abercrombie and Kent, to send people ahead to teach the chefs to make hamburgers and French fries for Buffett. To his delight, he was served course after course of his French fries, even for dessert. The following morning, the group set off to tour the Forbidden City, Beijing University, and the National Palace Museum. At Fengshan Restaurant for lunch, and again that evening at the Diaoyute State Guest House, an imperial family fishing ground and retreat, Buffett was served hamburgers and French fries, while the rest of the group feasted on Chinese cuisine. In Beijing, the group met the Premier of China, and Gates arranged a ping-pong match between Buffett and a 12-year-old champion. On the third day, Dr. Oxnam lectured on the history and folklore of the Great Wall. When they climbed to the top, the group found champagne awaiting them and cherry coke for Buffett. Looking down at the world's largest structure, which represented 11 centuries of innovative engineering, human labor, and Chinese history, everyone waited for Buffett to say something profound. Surely he would be moved by the sight. "Boy, I sure would have liked to have been the company that got the brick contract for this thing," he quipped. The following morning, he skipped the martial arts lesson in favor of a tour of the local Coca-Cola plant. The next day, the group boarded a Chinese military transport plane to fly to Urumqi, a town in far northwestern China near Mongolia that was once an important stop on China's Silk Road. There, they would board a train, no ordinary train, for the Gateses had arranged for the group to be the first Westerners to rent Chairman Mao's personal train for a journey across northwest China. The train followed the old Silk Road route, making stops along the way so that the group could ride camels in the desert, visit ancient cities and caves, see the giant pandas in Xi'an, and tour the archaeological dig of the Imperial Terracotta Warriors and Horses, believed to be the largest funerary site on Earth. The trip allowed for hours and hours of conversation, during which Buffett and Gates continued their discussions of why some banks are better than other banks, why retailing is such a tough business, the value of Microsoft stock, and the like. On the 10th day, they visited the site of the Three Gorges Dam project, then boarded the MS East Queen, a huge five-deck cruise ship with a ballroom, a barbershop, a masseuse, and a musician on the deck in formal clothes who played Turkey in the Straw. The boat passed into the first of the Three Gorges, the Shenongshi, where many of those on board donned orange life vests and climbed into longboats that were poled and pulled by river trackers along an upstream tributary of the river. A group of 10 men using ropes dragged each boat against the current, while young, supposedly virginal girls sang to encourage the men at their grueling work. Buffett cracked jokes about the virgins, but that night during the Cantonese dinner, his mind obviously flashing to the implications of the ovarian lottery, he said, "There could have been another Bill Gates among those men pulling our boat. They were born here, and they were destined to spend their lives tugging those boats the way they did ours. They didn't have a chance. It was pure luck that we got a shot at the brass ring." From Shenongshi, the boat steamed on to Uteng Gorge, passing villages where schoolchildren came out to bow with the strange Americans. Past a silk reeling mill, between sheer, mist-shrouded peaks, alongside a traditional cobblestone village, the boat slowly wound its way down the Yangtze. Finally, they arrived in Guilin for a private Lee River barge cruise through one of the most scenically beautiful spots on Earth, a pristine river lined with thousands of limestone pinnacles covered in a mantle of green, like jade hairpins, according to the Tang poet Han Yu. Many of the Gates party bicycled along the riverbank to experience the long waterside parade of 200- and 300-foot-high untouched prehistoric stone shafts. Warren, Bill Sr., and Bill Jr. had obtained permission from their wives to have an hours-long bridge orgy on the boat as the barge floated through the magnificent pine-forested landscape. When they finally arrived in Hong Kong at the end of the trip, Buffett towed the Gateses straight to McDonald's to buy hamburgers in the middle of the night. And all the way back from Hong Kong to San Francisco and then on to Omaha, I just read newspapers. But long after that journey through China, for years afterward, in fact, Buffett's mind kept returning over and over to one of its moments. It was not the scenery, which he had barely noticed, or the camel ride, memorialized in a photograph. It was not the endless meals of French fries during the Chinese banquets that everyone else had enjoyed. He was thinking about the Three Gorges Dam project and the longboats on the Shenongshi. But it was not the singing virgins that had beguiled him. It was the fate of the men who spent their lives ceaselessly dragging the longboats upstream that stayed with him, haunting his thoughts about individual destiny and fate. Chapter 51. To Hell with the Bear. Omaha and Greenwich, Connecticut, 1994 to 1998. Through the bridge, through the Gulf, through Ireland, through China, as late as 1994, Buffett devoured the Wall Street Journal every day looking for stock to buy for Berkshire Hathaway. But it was growing steadily more difficult to find a wonderful business at a fair price. He was still putting money into Coca-Cola until he had spent a total of $1.3 billion on 100 million shares. He bought another shoe company, Dexter. Here he was a little outside his circle of competence, making a bet that demand for imported shoes would wane. A jeweler named Barnett Helzberg Jr., who knew about Borsheim's, saw Buffett in New York in a conversation on Fifth Avenue and sold him Helzberg diamonds almost on the spot. Buffett was also buying American Express stock again. He wanted the rest of Geico. Since October 1993, Geico had been run by co-CEOs, its chief investment officer, Lou Simpson, and Tony Nicely, a soft-spoken, silver-haired teddy bear of a man who had worked there since he was 18 years old and now ran the insurance operations. Nicely had put the pedal to the floor, and Geico, after a period of dormancy, started adding 500,000 new customers a year. In August 1994, Buffett talked to Nicely, Simpson, and Sam Butler, the chairman of the board's executive committee, and the man who, many years before, had found Jack Byrne to rescue the company. Nicely, who did not enjoy dealing with Wall Street, had thought ever since he became co-CEO that Geico should be privately owned. He would much rather work for Buffett than a bunch of analysts and money managers. Butler led the negotiation. He wanted stock and a price in the 70s. Buffett regarded that as outrageous. He wanted to pay cash and a price in the high 50s. For a year, they bargained. Buffett pulled out the circular saw. This was his technique to cut the floor out from under Geico by trying to make Butler feel the company was weak and vulnerable. The market was getting out of hand, Buffett said. This high-tech internet stuff is going crazy, and it's going to hurt the whole industry, including Geico. You guys have a significant advantage selling over the telephone, but the internet is going to narrow that quite a bit. It was apparent that by 1994, before the average person even had an email address, Buffett, who supposedly knew nothing about computers, had already grasped how the internet was going to affect the auto insurance industry in the coming decades, better than the auto insurance industry itself had. But Butler was a tough and experienced lawyer and couldn't be buffeted. Berkshire's stock price had doubled in 2 years. That April, with BRK trading at $22,000 a share, Money Magazine cited the overpriced stock service newsletter, which said the price of BRK makes sense only if the company is run by God. Butler refused to lower his number. He wanted as many Berkshire shares as he could get. The two reached an impasse. Finally, Buffett resorted to the ultimate weapon and brought in Charlie Munger as the appointed bad guy. At Solomon, this had been predictably successful, but Sam Butler proved so tough that he couldn't even be mongered. After a year, it became clear that if Buffett wanted Geico, he was going to have to meet Butler's price. Buffett wanted Geico so badly that he capitulated. In August 1995, he paid $2.3 billion for 52% of Geico, after having spent $46 million for the first 48%. And he paid with Berkshire stock, not cash. Despite having fought so hard, Buffett actually regarded the price as reasonable, looked at as a whole, given the bargain he'd gotten on the first half of the stock. The Geico deal marked a turning point. The stock market had been on a tear, with new offerings of hot stocks unexpectedly popular in 1994, coming on the heels of a big 1993. In February 1995, the Dow hit 4,000 for the first time. Microsoft brought out Windows 95 and sold $700 million worth the first day. Suddenly, everyone who worked in an office had a computer on their desk. People bought computers for their kids to do homework after school. Mothers of kindergartners got email addresses to keep up with carpool news. Website designers couldn't meet the demand from businesses. Computer hackers made front-page news. In August 1995, an internet service provider named Netscape went public to raise money for its expansion. Many people were familiar with Netscape's product, but the company had never earned a dime. So many calls to buy the stock came in to banker Morgan Stanley that the company set up a toll-free number to handle them. Orders for 100 million shares poured in for a company that had originally wanted to sell 3.5 million shares. Despite Buffett's use of a computer to play bridge and the insights about the internet that he had displayed in bargaining for Geico, his knowledge of technology was spotty. He remained personally indifferent to computers, while the rest of the world couldn't buy them fast enough. Bill Gates took this as a challenge. He brought Buffett and Munger to a gathering at Microsoft to talk about technology. The evening before, he and Melinda held a dinner at their house at which she seated Munger with Nathan Myhrvold, Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft. The two soon fell into a lengthy conversation about naked mole rats. A naked mole rat looks like a boudin blanc, a French milk sausage, with teeth. It feels no pain when cut, scraped, or burned. They lack a neuropeptide called substance P that is critical to the transmission of pain and thus are often used as laboratory animals. Munger, a science buff, had some tangential knowledge on this topic. Sandy Gottesman had once invested in laboratory mice, trying to make a quick buck on rising demand for experimental animals. But Gottesman's investment hadn't worked out, and he got stuck with a building full of mice under some bridge in New York City. The naked mole rat was a superior beast, not only insensitive to pain, but parthenogenic. The queen of the colony fertilizes and gives birth without assistance from the males. Munger and Myhrvold held an animated conversation about the sex life of mole rats while the others sat listening in numb disbelief. The next morning, Gates took Buffett and Munger over to Microsoft so that his number two, Steve Ballmer, and half a dozen engineers could interview them, almost as anthropologists. So strange did it seem to them that these two incredibly brilliant men were such latecomers to the world of computers. They were like a couple of cavemen savants discovered in the bush who had seen an airplane but wouldn't take a ride. Despite his sense of the Internet's importance, for example, it had not yet occurred to Buffett to tell Geico to hurry up and exploit the Internet to sell insurance. To Buffett, computers were just tunnels that enabled him to reach other people who could play bridge. That was quite interesting to Bill, because he saw how some guy who had no interest in the computer per se could be drawn in by an application. The computer itself was interesting to all the people around him, but to me, only the application was interesting. You sell the computer first to people who are interested in computers, and then you sell it to people like me who don't give a damn about computers. Buffett, who deemed computers outside his circle of competence, might still have been the richest man in America instead of Gates had he bought stock in Microsoft and Intel. Instead, he was now number two. But he did not care. Or rather, he did care. He cared a lot. He would rather be number one. Much rather. but he cared far more about avoiding excess risk. He didn't know which company would turn into the next Microsoft or Intel and which would crash and burn. He would never give up his margin of safety. He knew that the life cycle of many technology businesses was as short as a naked mole rat's. Even had he been of the temperament to do so, Buffett didn't need to make risky bets. Decisions made years ago were still compounding for him. The hiring of Ajit Jain had meant that when Hurricane Andrew blew South Florida off the map in 1992, Buffett was able to start a new business, Catastrophe Reinsurance, which charged a premium price to stand by as insurer of the unthinkable. Then the Northridge earthquake hit. Almost no one else had the capital to put up billions on a risk like that, but Berkshire Hathaway did. Buffett's relationship with the Blumkins brought him the chance to buy R.C. Willey, a Salt Lake City-based furniture chain. The old days of scouring the Moody's manuals for teensy companies were long gone. Instead, he played White Knight once again to save flight safety from a corporate raider. This was a unique and profitable company that trained pilots and made the enormous flight simulators used for that training. He would go on to buy Star Furniture and International Dairy Queen. However, most of the ideas that were brought to him were what he called Cocker Spaniels, when he had asked for Collies. In reply to these proposals, "If the phone don't ring, you'll know it's me," he quipped in Berkshire's annual report. Some may have thought, if he'll buy Dexter Shoe, Buffett will buy anything. He was starting to regret that deal. Dexter was getting killed by foreign competition. People had not lost their interest in buying imported shoes. But the mistakes were few, and the home runs many. Cap City's ABC negotiated a deal to sell itself to Disney for $19 billion, and Berkshire made $2 billion, almost four times its original investment. Tom Murphy went on the board of Disney, and Buffett became linked to Michael Eisner, the CEO of Disney, through Murphy. At Sun Valley, the Buffetts now mingled easily with a crowd that ranged from Coca-Cola executives to movie stars. He also went back on the board of the Washington Post, which was now being run by Don Graham, one of his favorite people, enabling him to rejoin his favorite company in his favorite milieu, newspapers. In early 1996, Berkshire stock suddenly rocketed to $34,000 a share, valuing Berkshire as a company at $41 billion. An original partner who invested $1,000 in 1957 and left it untouched would now have $12 million stashed away, double the amount of just a couple of years before. Buffett himself was worth $16 billion. Susie now had $1.5 billion worth of Berkshire stock, which she had promised not to touch. Both she and Charlie Munger were now on the Forbes 400 list as billionaires. Once invisible, Berkshire was noticed by people who had never heard of it before. That year, 5,000 people from all 50 states came to the shareholder meeting Coombe Discount Mall. Buffett took pride in having never split the stock and swore he never would. "My ego is wrapped up in Berkshire," he said. "I can gear my whole life by the price of Berkshire." But now it cost so much to buy a share of BRK that copycats set up investment trusts. Their idea was to mimic Berkshire Hathaway's stock portfolio and let people buy in smaller units, as if it were a mutual fund. But Berkshire was not a mutual fund. It was a perpetual motion vacuum cleaner that sucked up businesses and stocks and spit out cash to buy more businesses and stocks. That couldn't be replicated by buying the stocks it owned. Among other things, you didn't get Buffett. Moreover, the copycat funds were buying the stocks that Berkshire owned at prices far higher than Berkshire had paid, and charging fat fees to do it. They were cheating investors. Now the cop in Buffett came out. "I don't want anybody buying Berkshire thinking that they can make a lot of money fast. They're not going to do it in the first place, and some of them will blame themselves, and some of them will blame me. They'll all be disappointed. I don't want disappointed people. The idea of giving people crazy expectations has terrified me from the moment I first started selling stocks." To foil the putative copycats, he decided to issue a new class of shares. Each B share, or Baby B, was equal to 3.33%, or 1/30th of a pricey A share. He had great fun with the B shares, writing, "Neither Mr. Buffett nor Mr. Munger would currently buy Berkshire shares at that price, nor would they recommend that their families or friends do so." He added that, "Current shareholders will not suffer any diminution in per-share intrinsic value, no matter how many Class B shares the company decides it is necessary to sell." By selling an unlimited amount of stock, they ensured that the price would not rise because of more demand than supply. You don't want people who think of it as something that can double, you know, and you can create your own market action for a while. I could have been a hero for a year as all the money poured into a fixed supply of stock. Instead, we said we would sell as much of this stuff as the world wants, and that way there is no way it can be a hot stock. At the same time, the inverted logic of selling stock that you wouldn't buy yourself and explicitly saying so pleased Buffett enormously. Moreover, issuing the B shares fulfilled a duty to his shareholder partners. All that cash pouring in from the B shares would be a pretty good deal for them. No CEO had ever done such a thing before. A small forest of trees was felled in media coverage of Buffett's honesty, yet investors gobbled up the B shares anyway. Buffett thought them foolish and said so, privately and often. Yet there was no denying it was enormously flattering that they did, for they were clearly buying only because of him. He would have been secretly disappointed had the B share offering been a flop. The B shares were a Buffett. His shareholders won, and Buffett won, no matter how the offering turned out. The baby bees forever changed the character of Buffett's club. After May 1996, 40,000 new owners could call themselves shareholders. The next year, he moved the meeting to the grimy old Exarban Coliseum, and 7,500 people showed up. They spent $5 million at the Nebraska Furniture Mart. The meeting turned into Woodstock for Capitalists, or BRK Fest. At the 1998 shareholder meeting, 10,000 people came. Yet as the money and the people and the fame kept rolling in, an underlying shift took place in the world in which Buffett worked that would have profound effects on him and everybody else. There really was no such thing as Wall Street anymore. Now, financial markets were a string of blinking terminals connected by computers hooked up to the Internet that reached every corner of the world. A guy named Mike Bloomberg, whom Solomon had been dumb enough to fire back in the 80s, had created a special computer that captured every piece of financial information that anyone could possibly want. It made graphs, it made tables, it did calculations, it gave news, it gave quotes, it could do historic comparisons and set up competitions between companies and bonds and currencies and commodities and industries for whoever was lucky enough to have a Bloomberg terminal on his or her desk. By the early 1990s, the Bloomberg terminal was becoming ubiquitous. The Bloomberg saleswoman had called Berkshire Hathaway for 3 years in a row. "Nope," was the answer every time. Buffett felt that following the market minute to minute and manipulating computers was not the way to invest. Finally, it became obvious even to computer-averse Buffett that to trade bonds, you had to have a Bloomberg terminal. But the Bloomberg sat some distance from Buffett's office, and he never looked at it. That was the job of Mark Millard, the bond trader. The advent of the Bloomberg terminal, symbol of the new computerized trading, mirrored the ongoing struggle over Solomon's identity, which continued within the firm. Its laggard businesses had never gotten back on their feet. In 1994, Maughan had tried to realign pay at Solomon on the theory that employees should shoulder the same risk as shareholders. When times were good, they would get bonuses. But when times were bad, they would suffer as well. There were people inside the firm who agreed with him. But that was not the standard anywhere else on Wall Street, so 35 senior people walked out the door. Buffett was disgusted with the employees' unwillingness to share the risk. Deprived of Meriwether to bonus pimp for them, the Arbs fought for their share. Buffett was willing to pay them for results. The firm still made most of its money from arbitrage, but increasing competition made it harder for them to produce. Arbitragers make a bet that a temporary gap of prices between similar or related assets will eventually tighten. For example, The bet may be whether two nearly identical bonds will trade at a closer price. With so much new competition, the easy trades had become scarcer. The ARBs took larger positions with more risk. When they were losing, they doubled down and increased the size of their trades. In both cases, they did so because margins on trades were falling, and doing bigger trades, often using debt, helped offset that. The rules of the racetrack said not to do so, because you don't have to make it back the way you lost it. The reason is the math of losing money, which works like this. If someone has a dollar and she loses 50 cents, she has to double her money to make back what she's lost. That's difficult to do. It is tempting to borrow another 50 cents for the next bet. That way, you only have to make 50%, plus the interest you owe on the loan, to get back whole. Much easier to do. But borrowing the money doubles your risk. If you lose 50% again, you're history. The loss has wiped out all your capital. Hence Buffett's sayings, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. Rule number three, don't go into debt. The ARB strategy, however, assumed that their estimate of value was right. Therefore, when the market moved against them, they only had to wait to make the money back. But risk defined this way, in terms of volatility, presumes the investor can be patient and wait. Of course, anyone who borrows to invest may not have that luxury of time. Moreover, to actually enlarge a losing trade required extra capital stashed somewhere that could be forked over on a moment's notice if the need arose. And capital has an opportunity cost. Larry Hillebrand lost $400 million, an enormous sum, arbitraging the difference in interest rates on mortgage-backed bonds. He was convinced that he could make back the loss on the mortgage arbitrage if the firm would double his bet. Buffett agreed with Hillebrand in this instance and gave him the money for the trade, which in fact reversed to become profitable. The ARBs had an almost supernatural belief in their own abilities, and as their corner of the market became crowded, they wanted to expand into even more types of arbitrage that involved more variables and less certainty. They relied heavily on computer models driven by complex mathematics, but always said these were only guideposts. Buffett and Munger felt that using models to make investment decisions was like driving a car on cruise control. The driver might think he was fully alert and attentive, but would find out differently when the road turned winding, rain-slicked, and full of traffic. What the ARBs really wanted, however, even more than capital to invest, was JM. During Solomon's recovery, Merriweather waited on the sidelines at first while the ARBs begged to bring him back. But while Derek Maughan made polite noises, everybody knew he did not want Merriweather back. Nevertheless, Buffett and Munger had given a thumbs up, with some conditions. Merriweather had to have supervision. He could return to his old position, but would have to report to Maughan, with less freedom to run his operation. Unwilling to work under a shorter leash, Merriweather had broken off negotiations, and in 1994 went off to found his own hedge fund, Long-Term Capital Management. It would operate the same way as the bond arbitrage unit at Solomon, except that Merriweather and his partners got to keep the profits. One by one, Merriweather's key lieutenants left Solomon to join him at the new harborfront offices of Long-Term Capital Management in Greenwich, Connecticut. Deprived of his biggest moneymakers, Derek Maughan saw the for sale sign heading for Buffett's block of stock and began planning for the day when Buffett would wash his hands of Solomon. In his 1996 shareholder letter, Buffett said that virtually all stocks were overvalued. Whenever the market ran hot, it was because Wall Street was in vogue. That year, Maughan thought it timely to pitch the restaurant in front of Solomon's Casino to Sandy Weill, CEO of Travelers Insurance, as the anchor tenant in a global financial shopping mall that could compete with Merrill Lynch. Weill supposedly still resented Buffett for the sweet deal Berkshire got after Weill's squeeze-out in the Fireman's Fund sale more than a decade earlier. He distrusted the arbitrage casino, but he saw an opportunity for the restaurant chain on a global scale. When he bought Solomon for Travelers, some observers felt that since Solly hadn't done well under Buffett, Weil saw it as a chance to beat Buffett at his own game. Buffett hailed Weil for the decision as a genius at building shareholder value, and Travelers paid $9 billion for Salomon, bailing Buffett out of his problem child investment. Meriwether, who knew that Buffett liked owning casinos, had gone to Omaha with one of his partners to try to raise money for long-term capital for its February 1994 launch. They ate the now obligatory dinner at Garratt's, where J.M. pulled out a schedule over his stake to show Buffett different probabilities of results and how much money long-term could make or lose. The strategy involved earning tiny profits on many thousands of trades, leveraged by at least 25 times the firm's capital. The highest loss that long-term contemplated was 20% of its assets, the odds of which it estimated at no more than 1 in 100. Nobody estimated the odds of losses bigger than that. If they did, no one would invest. The numbers wouldn't make sense. The projections in virtually all these types of models in every financial business always assumed the maximum earthquake-type loss could never happen because the expected returns were never high enough to compensate investors for taking that risk. The name long-term came from the fact that investors were locked in. Meriwether knew that if he started losing money, he needed the investors to stay until the losses turned around. But so much leverage, combined with no way to cap the risk completely, made Buffett and Munger uncomfortable. "We thought they were very smart people," says Munger, "but we were a little leery of the complexity and leverage. We were very leery of being used as a sales lead. We knew others would follow if we got in." Munger thought long-term wanted Berkshire as a Judas goat. "The Judas goat led the animals to slaughter in the stockyards," he says, recalling Omaha. "The goat would live for 15 years, and of course the animals that followed it would die every day as it betrayed them. Not that we didn't admire the intellect of the people at long-term." Long-term charged its clients 2 cents off every dollar under management every year that they invested, plus a quarter of any profits it earned. Clients signed up for the prestige, but the invest with a genius approach put off other funds and firms on Wall Street. Nevertheless, it raised $1.25 billion, the largest hedge fund startup in history. The old ARB team at Salomon now worked together in secrecy, with no outside interference and no more sharing of the profits with other parasitic Salomon departments. Indeed, the fund smoked in its first 3 years, quadrupling its investors' money. By the end of 1997, long-term had amassed $7 billion of capital. Then competition from startup hedge funds depressed returns. Meriwether sent $2.3 billion of money back to investors. The rest was all the market could digest. The hedge fund in Greenwich was now running more than $129 billion in assets and a like amount of debt, on only $4.7 billion of capital. In a near instant replication of Buffett's steady accumulation of wealth through the magic of fees earned on borrowed money, nearly half of the capital belonged to the partners themselves. Despite the 50-year-old Meriwether's difficulty making eye contact, he and his firm had a swagger to match their brilliant reputations, and the partners took full advantage of the fund's position to dictate terms to its clients, to the 50-something banks from which it borrowed, and to its brokers. In many cases, these parties were one and the same. Beating Buffett's record was now the goal of most money managers in worldwide finance. Some thought Meriwether had at least an unconscious grudge against Buffett for failing to protect him at Salomon, then subsequently not hiring him back. Unbeknownst to anyone, long-term capital was shorting Berkshire Hathaway, on the theory that BRK was overpriced relative to the value of the stocks that it owned. Not only that, long-term set up a Bermuda reinsurance company, Osprey Re, named after the copper osprey that sank its talons into helpless prey in the fountain outside long-term's building. Osprey Re was going to insure earthquakes, hurricanes, and similar natural disasters. It was, in other words, entering Ajit Jain catastrophe reinsurance territory. The ditches on the roadside of the insurance highway were filled with wreckage. Buffett, the soul of prudence, had barely escaped himself once or twice in his younger days. Whenever a novice came along, Better find the keys to the tow truck. Gradually, as Long-Term's coffers swelled and imitators followed for the next several years, through early summer of 1998, lenders collectively began to realize that, as periodically happens, they had gotten too euphoric about the prospects that all these people to whom they had lent money would pay them back. Long-Term's competitors started dumping their dodgier positions as interest rates rose. That pushed down prices and set off a cycle of selling. But Long-Term had bet the opposite way, selling the safest assets and buying the riskiest, which were relatively cheaper. Its intricate models basically said that over time the financial markets were becoming more efficient, so the prices of risky assets would converge toward the prices of safer assets. Its biggest trades were a formulaic guess that the market would become less volatile, meaning that as the market bounced around, it would oscillate in smaller arcs. And historically, that had been so. But as history had also shown, generally did not mean always. Long-Term knew that. It had made investors lock in their capital long enough to be safe, or so it thought. On August 17, 1998, Russia suddenly defaulted on its ruble debt, meaning it would not pay its bills. When a major government stiffs its lenders, worldwide financial markets shudder. Investors began dumping everything in sight. A money manager had warned Long-Term early on that its strategy of eking out teensy profits on a zillion trades was like picking up nickels in front of a bulldozer. Now, surprise, the bulldozer turned out to have a Ferrari engine, and it was racing toward them at 80 miles an hour. On Sunday, August 23rd, I was playing bridge on the computer. I picked up the phone, and it was Eric Rosenfeld at Long-Term. The boyish Rosenfeld, 45 years old and one of Meriwether's key lieutenants, was the person who had had the brain-numbing job of going through thousands of Moser's trades at Solomon and reconstructing what went wrong. Buffett liked Rosenfeld. Now he had been deputized by Meriwether to cut back the portfolio's size by selling the firm's merger arbitrage positions. I hadn't heard from him in years. With fear in his voice, Eric started to talk about me taking out their whole big stock arbitrage position, $6 billion worth. They thought stock arbitrage was mathematical. Responding reflexively, Warren buffeted Rosenfeld. I just said to Eric, I would take certain ones, but not all of them. By a few days later, the market's gyrations had cost Long-Term half its capital. The partners had spent a week talking to everybody in their well-connected database, trying to raise money before they had to report this dire news to their investors on August 31st. No dice. Now they agreed that Larry Hillebrand, the super-rationalist whose sobriquet on Wall Street was still the $23 million man for the outsized bonus that had set Moser off on his tear, would make a pilgrimage to Omaha and reveal what Long-Term owned. The next day, the Dow dropped 4% in what the Wall Street Journal referred to as a global margin call, with investors panicking and selling. Buffett picked up Hillebrand at the airport and drove him back to Kiewit Plaza. The modesty of Buffett's smaller office, staffed by a handful of people and piled with Coca-Cola memorabilia, contrasted markedly with Long-Term's enormous digs in Greenwich, which featured two pool tables and a 3,000-square-foot gym staffed by a full-time trainer. Hillebrand had gone deep into debt to pump up his personal investment in the firm, leveraging the leverage with which Long-Term had already leveraged itself. He spent the day going over every position the firm owned and stressing the incredible opportunity he was offering to Buffett. He wanted me to put in capital. He described the 7 or 8 big fundamental positions. I knew what was happening with relationships and on prices in these areas. I was getting more interested as time went along because they were crazy relationships and spreads. But he was proposing a deal to me that didn't make any sense. They thought they had time to play the hand out. But I said no, so that was that. Buffett told him, I am not an investor in other people's funds. He was only interested as an owner. Long-Term didn't want an owner, only an investor. It came close to finding somebody else, but then he backed out. By month end, when it had to report to its investors, the fund had lost $1.9 billion, almost half of its capital, through a historically unusual combination of stock market declines and almost hysterical aversion to risk in the bond markets. Since the model had contemplated losses of 20% as being a one-in-100-year event, like a moderate West Coast earthquake, this was somewhat like a Category 4 hurricane hitting New York City. Meriwether wrote his investors a letter saying losses of half the fund's money were a shock, but the opportunity set in these trades at this time is believed to be among the best that LTCM has ever seen. The fund is offering you the opportunity to invest in the fund on special terms related to LTCM fees. Long-term was behaving as though it could raise capital to wait out the crisis and profit from its turnaround. But with the kind of leverage it had taken on, it didn't have that option. This was the fallacy of defining risk as anything other than losing money. Long-term had not prepared for that. The firm's insular culture and years of getting its way had blinded the partners to the reality that no investor would put money in to save it without also taking control. The day he read this, Buffett wrote a letter to a colleague and forwarded Meriwether's entreaty, saying, "Attached is an extraordinary example of what happens when you get, 1, a dozen people with an average IQ of 160, 2, working in a field in which they collectively have 250 years of experience, 3, operating with a huge percentage of their net worth in the business, 4, employing a ton of leverage." "Anything times zero is zero," Buffett said. "A total loss is a zero. No matter how small the likelihood of a total loss on any given day, if you kept betting and betting, the risk kept stacking up and multiplying. If you kept betting long enough, sooner or later, as long as a zero was not impossible, someday a zero was 100% certain to show up." Long-term, however, had not even tried to estimate the risk of a loss greater than 20%, much less a zero. In September, the earthquake kept rumbling. Long-term searched desperately for money, having now lost 60% of its capital. Other traders had started putting the squeeze on the fund, shorting positions they knew long-term owned because they knew long-term needed to sell, which would force prices lower. Investors were fleeing anything risky in favor of anything safe, to a point that long-term's models had never considered possible because it made no economic sense to them. Long-term hired Goldman Sachs, which came in as a partner to buy half the firm. It needed $4 billion, an almost unimaginable sum for a hedge fund in distress to raise. Goldman Sachs got in touch with Buffett to see if he was interested in a bailout. He wasn't. However, he would consider teaming with Goldman to buy the entire portfolio of assets and debt. Together, they would be strong enough to wait the crisis out and trade the positions deftly for a profit. But Buffett had a condition. No Meriwether. Long-term owed money to a subsidiary of Berkshire. It owed money to people who owed money to Berkshire. It owed money to people who owed money to people who owed money to Berkshire. "Derivatives are like sex," Buffett said. "It's not who we're sleeping with, it's who they're sleeping with that's the problem." As Buffett headed to Seattle that Friday to meet the Gateses and embark on a 13-day gold rush trip from Alaska to California, he called a manager and told him, "Accept no excuses from anyone who doesn't post collateral or make a margin call. Accept no excuses." He meant that if the Howie equivalents out there paid the rent one day late, then seize their farms. The next morning, he, Susie, the Gateses, and three other couples flew to Juneau to helicopter over the ice fields. They cruised up the fjords to view huge blue icebergs and waterfalls cascading over 3,000-foot cliffs. But as Buffett sat politely through a slide presentation on glaciology on board the ship that evening, his mind wandered to whether Goldman Sachs would be able to put together a bid for long-term. Predatory sellers had pushed prices so far down that long-term was a cigar butt. An opportunity to buy such a large bundle of distressed assets had never arisen so quickly in his career. The next day, the Gates party went ashore at low tide to view the hundreds of brown grizzly bears that frequented Pack Creek. John Corzine, the head of Goldman Sachs, called Buffett on his satellite phone, but kept being cut off. The phone didn't work because of these half-mile-high rock walls on either side of the boat. The captain would point out, "Look, there's a bear." I was saying, "To hell with the bear. Let's get back where I can hear the satellite phone." 2 or 3 hours went by with Buffett held incommunicado as the party spent the afternoon crossing Frederick Sound so they could view the humpback whales. Corzine stewed in New York before he regained brief and final contact with Buffett. By the time Buffett resignedly trudged off to view a slideshow on Alaskan marine wildlife that evening, Corzine had gathered that he could make a bid, as long as the investment had nothing to do with and was not managed by John Merriweather. On Monday, Buffett remained out of touch, and Corzine grew pessimistic about working out a bid. He had begun to talk with Peter Fisher, who ran trading activities at the Federal Reserve, and was drawing together long-term creditors to negotiate a joint bailout. The Federal Reserve had held a conference call at which its chairman, Alan Greenspan, spoke of an international financial maelstrom that must be causing considerable breakage to crockery somewhere. Hope began to stir that the Fed would cut interest rates. Meanwhile, long-term lost another $500 million. The banks, picking over its books, were using what they learned against it. The fund now had less than $1 billion of capital left. The irony was the $2.3 billion it had paid out to its own investors a year before in order to increase the share of the fund owned by its partners. If it had that money now, long-term might have been in a position to survive on its own. Instead, it had $100 of debt for every dollar of capital, a ratio no sane lender would ever entertain. Buffett was en route to Bozeman, Montana, with the Gates Party, but Corzine had reached him earlier that morning and gained permission to enlist a large insurer, AIG, which owned a derivatives business, to join the bid. Its chairman, Hank Greenberg, was on friendly terms with Buffett. AIG had the experience and the team to replace Merriweather as manager, and Greenberg's powerful presence would balance out Buffett's, and it might make Buffett's bid more palatable to Merriweather. The next morning, 45 bankers arrived at the Fed, as summoned, to discuss a bailout of the customer that had bullied them so relentlessly for the past 4 years. Long-term had them over a figurative barrel once again, for if it went down, other hedge funds would go down with it. As one domino fell after another, a global financial meltdown was a real possibility, a repeat of Solomon. This was the warning that Buffett and Munger had been repeating at their shareholder meetings since 1993. Some of the banks now feared for their survival unless they helped save the fund. They were reluctantly contemplating putting more money into long-term, money that would only go to pay long-term's debts, on top of money they had already invested in the fund and lost. When Corzine told them Buffett was also bidding, the idea that he was going to come in and buy it to make a killing went down poorly, even though he would be bailing everybody out. Somehow, Buffett always won. People found it irksome. New York Federal Reserve Bank President William McDonough called Buffett to find out if he was serious. About to board a bus for Yellowstone National Park, Buffett told McDonough that yes, indeed, he was ready to make a bid and could do so on short notice. He couldn't see why the Federal Reserve would be orchestrating a bailout when Berkshire, AIG, and Goldman Sachs, a group of private buyers, stood ready to solve the whole problem without government assistance. He called long-term around 11 o'clock New York time on a crackly satellite phone and said, "I want you to know, I'm going to bid for the entire portfolio. You'll hear from my representatives, but I want you to know it's coming from me, and I hope you'll take it seriously." I didn't want to hold the bus up, so I went along. It was killing me, and Charlie was in Hawaii. I still knew the basic positions that were involved, and I knew these spreads were really getting more and more extreme. On that Wednesday morning, it was changing by the hour. An hour later, Goldman faxed a single page to Merriweather, offering to buy the fund for $250 million. As part of the deal, Merriweather and his partners would be fired. If Merriweather accepted, AIG, Berkshire, and Goldman would put another $3.75 billion into long-term, with Berkshire funding most of that. To minimize the chance of long-term shopping the bid to gin up a higher offer, Buffett had given them only an hour to decide. By then, Long Term had just over $500 million left, and Buffett was bidding just under half that. After paying off debt and losses, Meriwether and his partners would be wiped out, their nearly $2 billion of capital gone. But the document had been drafted by Goldman with a mistake in it. It offered to buy LTCM, the management company, instead of its assets, which Meriwether knew was what Buffett wanted. Meriwether's lawyer said he needed his partner's consent to sell the entire portfolio rather than the management company. Long Term asked for a temporary emergency investment pending receipt of the approvals, but they couldn't reach Buffett on his phone. If they'd reached him, he said later, he would have taken that deal. While everybody else in the Gold Rush trip was looking at Hot Springs, Buffett was dialing and redialing the satellite phone in Yellowstone, trying to call Corzine at Goldman and Hank Greenberg at AIG. The phone didn't work. He had no idea what was going on back in New York. The people at Long Term did not know what was going on in the room with the bankers, where McDonough was in a quandary. He had an offer from the Berkshire Goldman AIG consortium, but no deal. It was hard to justify government involvement in orchestrating a bailout when there was a viable private bid on the table. Finally, he told the assembled bankers that the other bid had failed for structural reasons. Buffett was not there to make a counterargument. The Federal Reserve brokered a deal in which 14 banks put up a total of $3.6 billion. Only one bank, Bear Stearns, refused to participate, earning the long-lasting enmity of the rest. Meriwether's crew negotiated an arrangement for themselves that they considered slightly better than indentured servitude. That night at the Lake Hotel, Buffett found out what had happened. He felt that Meriwether didn't want to sell to him. If he had wanted to, he would have found a way. Perhaps it had weighed on Meriwether's mind that, as one of the fund's partners said, Buffett cares about one thing, his reputation. Because of the Solomon scandal, he couldn't be seen to be in business with JM. Meriwether had certainly gotten a better deal from the bailout than he would have with Buffett. The next day, as they boarded the bus to visit Old Faithful Geyser, Buffett was still turning over in his mind whether there was some way to undo it. Gates had a treat in store. When they arrived in Livingston, Montana, in early afternoon, to board a 9-car private train fitted out with burnished wood and polished leather that Gates had rented, Sharon Osberg was waiting along with Fred Gittleman, a low-key computer programmer and bridge player. Gates had flown them in. While everyone else was admiring the cliffs and waterfalls of the Wind River Canyon, the foursome retired to an upstairs lounge with a transparent dome for a 12-hour bridge marathon. Periodically, Buffett's phone rang, and he talked with someone in New York about Long Term as the spectacular scenery rolled past. It still might not be too late to unwind the impending bailout and resurrect a private deal. But it wasn't working out. At least the bridge distracted him. The next morning, after a final round of bridge, the train rolled to a halt and dropped Osberg and Gittleman off in Denver, then continued through Devil's Hole Canyon and Dead Man's Gulch. Over the next few days, as the others went whitewater rafting and mountain biking, and the train wound its leisurely way to the Napa Valley via the Grand Canyon, Buffett read about the rescue in the newspapers and gradually lost hope of participating. Only 7 years after the regulators had contemplated letting Solomon fail, with all the consequences that that potentially entailed, the Federal Reserve had now engineered the bailout of a private investment firm, an unprecedented intervention in the market to avoid a similar event. Afterward, the Fed slashed interest rates 3 times in 7 weeks to help keep the financial stumble from paralyzing the economy. It was by no means certain that any such paralysis would occur, but the stock market took off like a screaming banshee. Long-term's partners and most of the staff worked for a year for $250,000, pauper's wages for people used to making millions a year, to unwind the fund's positions and pay back most of the emergency creditors. Hillebrand, in debt for $24 million, signed the employment contract with tears streaming down his cheeks. Still, nobody starved, even though Eric Rosenfeld had to auction off Long Term's wine collection. Most of them got good jobs afterward. Meriwether made a comeback to start a smaller, less leveraged fund taking some of his team. People thought the partners had gotten off light, considering that they had nearly sent the whole financial world into a seizure, and Buffett considered it one of the great missed opportunities of his life. Eric Rosenfeld had an insight. Maybe models didn't work when the world went mad. For that, you needed a lot of capital, the kind that Berkshire Hathaway offered. After all, if you were going to bet by $100 billion or more in favor of risk, you needed a partner, even a parent, one with so much capital that it essentially undid the leverage, somebody to provide a big umbrella in a storm. By implication, maybe they would have been better off being owned by somebody like Berkshire Hathaway. But that would have meant giving up their ownership. You couldn't have it both ways. If you wanted Berkshire to take the risk and put up the money, to it went the gains. To think otherwise was unrealistic, that somehow risk could be laid off to someone else without also giving up the rewards. But that point of view was growing and beginning to dominate the financial markets of the late 1990s. It would have profound consequences over time. It is hard to overstate the significance of a central bank-led rescue of a private money manager. If a hedge fund, however large, was too big to fail, then what large financial institution would ever be allowed to collapse? The government risked becoming the margin of safety. No serious consequences had come about in the end from the derivatives' near meltdown. The market afterward seemed to behave as if no serious consequences ever could. This threat, the so-called moral hazard, was a chronic worry of regulators. But the world would always be full of people who loved risk. When it came to business, Buffett's veins were filled with ice, but plenty of other people's pulsed with adrenaline much of the time. Some of them had even been members of his own family.